Hey folks, it's John. Welcome back to another episode of Talk to Me in the Car, a podcast about all things teaching related and education inspired. And I record right here in my vehicle on my drive back from work as a high school instructional coach. Today's podcast will be a little bit more serious, a little less upbeat, but hopefully there's an upshot of hope in all of it. We're talking about these awful news items that have come through the past 2 weeks from Atlanta and then this week in Boulder, Colorado. And the terror and the awful involving the seeming fascination of the United States with guns and gun violence, and how that has everything, unfortunately, to do with teaching, and nothing to do with teaching, and that's a really scary thing, so we'll talk about that today. If you like what you're hearing, feel free to like or subscribe, leave a comment on your favorite podcasting app that helps other people find the show. Hit me up on Twitter. I'm on Twitter at MeehanEDU, and I will gladly catch up with you. Or head on my website. I'm www.adrenalinerush.com. Has all of my templates from my first book, which is all about game-changing student engagement, inspired by theme parks, mud runs, and escape rooms. If you want to check that. But today I want to talk more about directly these issues of gun violence and school shootings and these mass shootings, which seems to be the story of the United States. And as we move out of a time of quarantine and isolation, we're back in the times where people are around one another and back in places where we can finally be with people. Right on schedule, we see the latest outbreak of these mass shootings. Last week in Atlanta, there was a shooting spree that took place and claimed the lives of more than half a dozen people. And it seemed to have been a racially motivated hate crime. And this week, there was a mass shooting in Boulder, Colorado, claimed the lives of 10 persons, including a police officer. And I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a psychologist, I'm a classroom teacher and a school coach. And when we talk about professional development for teachers, you kind of have to have those hard conversations, right? And what's interesting to me is there's always, you know, the talking heads, there's always the spin cycle, there's always the media echo chamber, and there's always the people who are looking for talking points. And there's nothing right that's happening right there. But there's always that conversation about, oh, it's too soon, this is not the time, this is a time for thoughts and prayers, this is not the time for, you know, gun reform, this is not the time for X or Y or Z. Whether that's the NRA is a very powerful lobby in Washington, or, you know, the distribution of power between states' rights and these, you know, federal laws, what we call common sense gun laws, don't seem to happen in the United States. And so, almost like right on schedule, the time when we finally should be getting together is now a time where people are once again worried that when they get together, they might be blown apart. That's awful. I want to spend some time today talking about some of the education elements of that, because in truth, we're not going to fix it as classroom teachers by ourselves. It's certainly not a thing that we do absent the help and support of our Congress and our Senate, our elected officials. But I do think there are things we can do in our school, and I wanted to talk about some of that stuff today if I could. So let's give it a shot. There's a book by Harvard University Press. It's called Instructional Rounds in Education. And it talks about how schools can improve by doing observations of teachers. Like, teachers can observe one another. And it borrows its ethos from the medical community, the idea of the medical round, right? Walking into an operating theater and seeing fellow surgeons just doing the job of what a surgeon does. And the theory is that by having people talk to one another in the building from different backgrounds, different areas, they have occasion to kind of force themselves to talk about the shared craft of their teaching or their medical practice. You know, if you take a surgeon and put him in a room with a surgeon, they're going to talk about surgery. That makes sense, right? But if you take a surgeon and put him in a room with a pediatrician, they're going to talk about medicine, which is what it means to be a doctor. It's a good thing. If you take an English teacher and put him in a room with an English teacher, they'll probably talk about their favorite books. But if you take an English teacher and put him in a room with a math teacher, invariably the first thing they'll lead into a conversation is their shared practice of teaching. It's a good thing. Talking about things, raising hard conversations, getting to those critical conversations that get past that what they call culture of nice. So many schools are plagued by the culture of nice, where we come in politely and sit down and grade our papers in a time the PD is running in the background, and we think all the while, nah, that could have been an email. But you know what? I'm getting paid for the day. I can wear jeans. I'm out of here at noon. don't ask questions, in and out we go. You see things that disrupt or bother you, and you're like, well, you know what? Don't fight City Hall. You got a good thing going. Let's just call it a day. They gave us free lunch, something like that. You see mediocre teaching or mediocre policy passing for acceptable or good policy, and everyone's encouraged to just not upset the apple cart because that's the way it's done around here. And what ends up happening is we allow things to subsist because we don't have those conversations. We don't have these occasions to just be intentional and bump into each other and say, what the heck is going on? And in the instructional regimen education book, they ask a question about students in school, and they link it to some very darker things, which seems relevant in today's conversation, so that's why I bring it up. But they say, in a classroom, could you be with a student in a 40-minute class in high school, and you just have so much stuff to cover that day, or, you know, a million things are happening, that you call on students if they have questions, but otherwise it's pretty much teacher-directed. Could a child go through an entire class period in a high school classroom, in this hypothetical space, on a given day, and not be called on, not be seen, or not be, you know, heard, other than just to be like, oh, present, and then back to the lesson we go, right? Actually ask their opinion, to have a conversation, to be seen as a human. And they said, of course, you know, I mean, that's the plague of many high schools, is the talkative kids want to talk, the quiet kids want to be quiet, and what ends up happening is in the traditional, look, I only got 40 minutes to cover it, especially coming back from COVID, like, there's all this quote-unquote learning loss, right? We have to make up for lost time. So we just keep shoving 10 pounds of you-know-what in a 5-pound bag. What ends up happening then is a teacher does a lot of the talking, 80 to 90% of the talking in the classroom. And then the other 10% is shared between three or four, you know, star students, but everyone else is just kind of sit down, shut up, and take notes. They said, let's play this out. They say in the book, you know, if a kid could be quiet during first period, not say a thing, is it possible that that same student could be or would be quiet during second period? And if second period, then how about third? Fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth. Over the course of a single day, is it possible that a single child might go through the entire day of school never once having been asked their opinion or been asked to contribute anything meaningful to a discussion? And as the conversation goes in the instructional rounds in education book, I say if the answer is yes, is it any wonder that students feel detached and isolated and devoid of human contact in a school that feels overly mechanized, feels like a machine, right? They're supposed to be just, you know, at best, dutiful little buckets to be full by what the teacher has to pour out or dispense onto them. At worst, they start to feel like meat through a grinder, because this game of school is going to be a big machine that runs with or without them. We have 10 days of nightly homeworks. We have a spot check quiz every fifth day and a big unit test every 10th day. We take the average of all of those grades. We call it the grade for the unit. We say, Billy, you are a good student, but until you got that test and then you got a bad test grade, we average out 10 nightly homeworks that were clearly copied or cheated on with a perfect score, with a test that's a real measure of what they've learned once every 2 weeks, and they got like a 60 on that. And if we get 100 free points for homework and a 60 for the test, you say, yeah, he just has to apply himself more. He's not a great test taker. And on we go, rinse and repeat, start the brand new unit on Monday the 1st of the next week. What ends up happening is the students start to feel disposable, interchangeable. They still feel like they don't matter. Our connections are weakened. We feel a lack of empathy towards the other people in our space. My students said in their own surveys, they said that this 6-foot social distancing for so many of their classes has felt like 6 miles. Because when you're in class, to be so close to someone and feel yet you have no connection to them is a very scary experience, a very isolating experience. William Shakespeare wrote, the drowning man in sight of shore drowns twice. You know, when you can see it, you're like, ah, dang it, it's just right there out of my reach. And that's what hurts all the more, right? To know that you're that close to people, but feel like you're alone in a crowded room kind of feeling. That's a scary thing. And as we talk about things like school shooting, and we talk about things like people who are, you know, objectively sociopathic in their behavior, right? They lack empathy for any other human being. More and more studies, more and more research, more and more conversations about people who find themselves on death row or find themselves in, you know, a prison system are interviewed and asked about, like, what's the common thread here? What is the thing that makes people tick or not tick? It makes people who are otherwise objectively raised in the same household as everyone else do these awful things, these tragic things, these outcomes that lead to people not valuing the life of another person. And time and time and time again, the surgeries come back, the conversations come back that these persons on death row did not play with others when they were kids. They did not have a lot of friends. They did not have occasion to make, you know, meaningful connections outside of their own home. There's a lot of studies, but I think it'll be a good idea. And I know I'm cherry-picking data and oversimplifying, but it's my podcast. You don't like it, don't listen, whatever. I'm pointing to, there are relevant trends here that are important and worth noting. There's all the studies about people who are serial killers, people who go on to do, you know, grisly, violent, brutal things. And so many of them start with their first victims in the home. And often it's because they lack social connections. The awful stories we hear about these school shooters, these people who go on to do just these barbaric things, they turn against the people who they are closest to, because the people who they're closest to are the only people who they know. That's a terrifying thing. They lack empathy. They lack human connection. They lack these moments to laugh with one another, to play with one another, to see other people as people, rather than just to see them as, you know, fellow meat through a grinder in a place where they feel like they don't matter. We also have these issues that absolutely need to be discussed of things like, you know, entitled isms, whether it's racism or classism, ableism, sexism. These people who feel burned or spurned, or that somehow there was an imaginary ladder that someone jumped over them, and they feel forgotten or lost in this big world. They don't understand how it feels to play with others, and so they choose not to play with others. They choose to destroy. And it's not an accident in so many of these spaces that they happen in these public spaces by people who are traditionally middle class, male, heterosexual, white. And there seems to be a trend there that says, this is a public space. I am of the ruling class. I am of this entitled class. I am of the wealthy class. I am male. This space is mine. I'm entitled to walk around. And they feel threatened when they feel things like Black Lives Matter. And I'm not saying the political organization, just the idea that a black life would matter, the life of a black person, the life of a person who is LGBT, that we saw at the Pulse nightclub shooting. Right? We see these people who are saying, if everyone else gets their piece of the pie, then I'm going to somehow lose my entitled space if I'm threatened. They do it in these very public spaces. There's all this research psychology about how and why mass shooters choose to go to public spaces to make these statements. I think we need to do a better job, and I don't think the answer lies just in gun reform. I think it lies in education reform. It lies in helping people feel connected to one another and empathetic towards one another, and not like meat through a grinder, giving them opportunities to talk to one another, to be seen. It's no accident that the first wave of these brutal school shootings that came on the heels of the Columbine High School immediately started schools to do things like a mentoring program, because they found that these shooters never had a single person in the building who was an adult who just checked in on them for no other purpose than just to check in on them. There was always somebody who was giving them a grade, or making sure that they were passing certain tests, or, you know, in behavioral problems. But all these things like mentorship, or like homeroom, just to have another adult in the building who checks in on you, a chance to just be, hey, you're not in trouble with me, I just want to say, how are you doing, man? Hey, it's good to see you. Today's fundamentally different because you showed up. I missed you. Nice haircut. Aw, man. What are you listening to? Human moments. Authentic connections. The things that make our jobs worth doing. We don't teach content, we teach people, right? And seeing people as people, recognizing them, celebrating them, elevating them, challenging them, pushing them, helping them connect, helping them grow. I think our schools need to do that, especially in these times when we're coming back from this time away. There is learning loss, but there's also loss of connection. And whatever we can do to make our schools feel more connected, our classrooms more connected, ultimately makes our students feel more connected, and that's a good thing. I don't have all the answers, but I know for my part as an educator, it's something that I do make a real purpose of concern focus. It's not just researching gun violence, not just researching statistics on school shootings. It's not just researching gun reform or lobbyist efforts. All that stuff's important, too. But it starts with those moments of human connection, and not just a very special after-school episode where we say thoughts and prayers and lower the flag halfway every time this happens, and then say, oh, I couldn't have seen it coming. In a country where it happens all the time, we always pretend like we're surprised. You know, and then we say, well, it's the media, it's the violence, it's the video games. Those video games come from Japan, and Japan doesn't have these problems. Like, well, you know, we all this racial tension and all this idea of, you know, there's differences between groups. Yeah, that's true in the United States. Germany has its fair share of that stuff, too. Germany doesn't have these mass shootings that we have, to the number and frequency and the degree. And we have these skeletons in the closet about racism and sexism and ableism, and they are all things that need to be addressed. And they exist in other countries. They're not just unique to the United States. And yet, here in the U.S., time and again, we see these sorts of things. The sensible gun care and gun law seem to figure somehow into the solution? 100%. Political reform? Yeah, you bet. But something about an educational reform, the change starts at home. And that starts for us in our schools to tell our kids, hey, when you're here, it's fundamentally different because you showed up. And you had the ability to affect the world in a positive way. And I think there's that line from Frankenstein, which I keep coming back to every time I hear one of these school shootings, where Frankenstein, the monster, Frankenstein is the doctor who creates the monster. But in some ways, Frankenstein is the monster because he's created this creature. But Frankenstein's creature tries to meet with people, tries to connect with people, tries to love people. He walks up to a girl next to a river, right, and everyone freaks out. He's actually very articulate in the book. He wants to be empathetic, he wants to connect. And there's these moments in the book where he's just trying to be seen and be heard, be connected, be loved. And at one point or another, and I'm not trying to defend anybody who's a perpetrator, I'm not. I'm just trying to speak to what the nature of that book is specifically. Frankenstein's monster says, if I cannot inspire love, then I will cause fear. And it's, if I cannot be seen for my attempts to make positive connections, real connections, human connections, if I'm laughed at, if I'm scorned, if I'm called a freak or a weirdo, if I'm bullied or blamed or shamed, it puts you in a different headspace. And over a certain time, this is a 200-year-old book that tells the story of so many of these kids who are these trench coat mafia types, or these bullied or blamed or shamed students. And there's a certain empathy that we have to have towards people who have undergone some terrible things in our own life that would make them feel so disconnected that they feel the only way for them to connect is by doing these wild acts of violence. It's indefensible. It's period, full stop, awful. Where you can get into the psychology behind it and say this comes from a lack of empathy, a lack of connection. And that goes for everyone involved. We need to help people feel more connected. We need to help our students who are on the fringes feel like they're not invisible or forgotten. We have to help the students who are prone to things like suicide and self-harm and sociopathy. Like, we need to get them back to feel like they are part of this thing together. You know, no man is an island. Like, man by nature is a social creature. We know this. Giving ourselves time in our classrooms for our students to be seen and to be heard. And not just when bad stuff happens, just to say, hey, I'm checking a box. We'll all check in for 5 minutes. Are we okay? Is everyone in agreement? Okay. Or a moment of silence for the latest victims? Okay, and back off to work we go. But like a radical recommitment to the human element of bringing people together and saying, hey, when you're here, you're safe. And we're better because you showed up. And everyone here has something to learn from everyone here. And that's a really good thing. It gets rid of things like ableism, classism, racism, sexism. It gets rid of this transphobia or this homophobia or this fear that you're going to have your spot taken by somebody else. Because you see yourself as part of this team, this idea, this human race. No man is an island, and all of us are connected so that when something bad happens in these tragedies, we pause and say, I missed that person. That person was a good person. Being around that person made me a better person. It made me more in tune with the human condition. Again, math teachers talk to math teachers, they talk about math. English teachers talk about English with other English teachers. But teachers just talk to teachers, and we just talk about teaching. Humans talk about other human stuff with other humans. We all get better at being human. We have to do more of that. I hope you're safe. I hope you're well. Please stay home. Wear a mask. Get those shots. And we'll be back at it. Think about ways we can make these small changes in our classrooms. Join me in the conversation on Twitter at MeehanEDU. Or hit me up at EMC2Learning, where we're trying to engage the speed of life and having space to create conversations about things we can do to not just change the game in education, but really start to change the world. Thanks again. See you next week.